The mayor's office says that slurs referring to a black woman were scrawled about 5 feet wide at the base of the arches over City Hall's front doors. The hateful words are now covered with a tarp. But at a press conference, Mayor London Breed said she'd seen a recent spike in racism and sexism.
This is not unfamiliar to me. I do deal with this every day, whether it's, you know, things that are said on social media, as well as emails that I received that describe me as exactly what was on this wall, or even in front of my own home.
Surveillance video of the incident has not yet been released. The sheriff's office is investigating. I'm Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez, KQED News.
And I'm Natalia Navarro.
Marketplace is just ahead here on KQED. Today's show includes a lesson about seasonal adjustments, what the term actually means and how it's calculated. Then at 4:30 on All Things Considered, we'll hear a report on a race that could determine control of the U.S. Senate. That's in the first segment of All Things Considered, which starts at 4:30 here on KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highland Sacramento. It's 4 o'clock.
Marketplace is supported by Betterment, the automated investing platform that helps make it easy to be invested for the long term. Learn more at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk.
You know, sometimes what happens in this economy really is all about how you feel. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Viking, exploring the world in comfort. With a fleet of small ships, Viking offers travel experiences for the thinking person. Discover more at Viking.com. And by The Economist, devoted to providing independent journalism that makes sense of the news shaping the world. More at Economist.com or with The Economist app, newsletters, and podcasts.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 5th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The marketplace number of the day today is 3. 3 followed by 12 zeros. 3 trillion. More precisely, $3.012 trillion. That's the market capitalization of NVIDIA, the AI chip design behemoth, as of the close today. And while yes, market cap is fundamentally simply formulaic, price per share times the number of outstanding shares. On another level, it's a measure of wealth, about how people are feeling about this stock or that. At the end of last year, the total value of all stocks in the United States was almost $51 trillion. Just 5 years ago, it was $32 trillion. Americans are, on average, much richer now on paper. Whether and how much all that paper wealth actually seeps into our real-life spending, that's what economists call the wealth effect. And those same economists, oh, they disagree on how strong it is. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
If you feel good, you spend good. That is the idea behind the wealth effect.
If you see a lot of green on the screen and your 401k looks a lot fatter and, you know, you looked at Zillow and you saw the price was up for your home, you feel better about things.
Mark Zandi is chief economist at Moody's Analytics. Paper wealth pumps you up and you're spending too.
You know, go out to dinner, have a nice bottle of wine or something.
The reverse is true too. If your stocks are crashing, you are less likely to splurge. It also depends on what kind of paper wealth you have.
Stock wealth is one thing. Housing wealth is another thing. Crypto is another thing altogether.
Crypto is so volatile, you might not actually trust that you are that much richer. But the wealth effect isn't entirely psychological, especially these days. In the first quarter of this year, Americans earned $11 trillion in interest and dividends, according to the Bureau of Economic Analysis. That is the most ever.
In general, on average, through time, across assets, I'd say for a dollar increase in someone's net worth, their spending will increase about 2 pennies.
Some economists believe it's much, much higher, maybe more than 30 cents on the dollar, driven by more retirees and more household wealth. Whatever the fraction is, the numbers are huge.
Total market capitalization of all U.S. publicly traded stocks is around 2 times the size of the U.S. economy.
Doug Ramsey is chief investment officer at the Luthold Group.
The long-term average is for the stock market to be a little bit smaller than the size of the GDP.
If paper wealth is an engine of consumer spending, It ran hot coming out of the pandemic, argues Tuan Nguyen, U.S. economist for RSM. He believes the wealth effect is particularly strong.
It was certainly one of the main reasons why inflation reached 9% 2 years ago.
Today, the wealth effect might be doing something different.
Helping to keep the economy running strong instead of running hot.
All that paper wealth could be, he says, one reason the U.S. economy has defied predictions of imminent recession again and again. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Speaking of wealth on paper, the Lone Star State is getting its own stock exchange headquartered in Dallas. The announcement came today from the TXSE Group. Get it? Texas TX Stock Exchange Group, backed by heavy hitter investors like BlackRock and Citadel Securities. Thing is, though, stock trading today is A, national, you can trade from anywhere, and B, it is online mostly. So does the South really need its own exchange? Reporting from her home state of Texas, but not in Dallas, Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall has the story.
Word of the Texas Stock Exchange came as positive news to Rice University finance professor John Diamond.
Not just because I live in Texas, but I think it's great because it adds competition.
Another place where companies can go to access capital besides the NASDAQ and New York Stock Exchange. And he says Dallas is a strategic city.
The financial sector, there's enough headquartered public companies in Texas to make it make sense.
But Jonah Crane with financial advisory firm Claros Group says trading isn't happening where used to.
For a fully electronic exchange, having the exchange located in Texas really just means that you have a bunch of data centers located in Texas. Most exchanges are not physical places where trading takes place in person.
It's not so much about Texas, but getting away from the growing list of rules that the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ have imposed in recent years. One example?
Any company that lists on the NASDAQ exchange has to observe certain board diversity requirements. That's become a somewhat controversial requirement.
But to compete with the New York exchanges, Michigan State University's Jiang Min says the Texas Stock Exchange will have to focus on attracting a large trade volume.
Even if their purpose is to provide a very different set of regulatory rules, they still need to focus on the fundamentals, yeah, to achieve the goal.
Fundamentals like a reliable platform and lower fees. In Houston, I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, see also wealth effect. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. To the labor market, we return now ahead of the May unemployment report we're going to get on Friday morning. Wednesdays, during the first week of the month, we get data from ADP, the payroll processing company, which said on this particular Wednesday that the private sector added 152,000 jobs in May. That is fewer than were added in April, so a bit of a slowdown. Maximum employment, as you might recall, is part of the Federal Reserve's dual mandate. Inflation, that is stable prices, is the other. And as it happens, there is an idea in economics that those two things, unemployment and inflation, are linked. It's called the Phillips curve. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has today's explainer.
Economist A.W. Phillips came up with what's known as the Phillips curve in 1958. It says that low unemployment is linked to high inflation. Ann Owen is a professor of economics at Hamilton College.
When unemployment is low, wage increases have to be larger.
Companies are competing for fewer available workers, so they up their wages to bring them in. But that costs money, so
they need to be able to pass those higher costs along to consumers in the form of higher prices.
In other words, inflation. And if that's the case, it's kind of a bummer, right? Because it means in order to slow inflation, more people need to be out of work.
That's why they call economists the dismal scientists, right? Because we're kind of bumming people out all the time, telling you about the trade-offs.
Monetary policymakers can use the Phillips curve, says Allison Lutke, professor of economics at St. Olaf College.
If you're like, I'm really going after unemployment, good. But be aware there might be the cost of higher inflation.
Except the Phillips curve relationship sometimes breaks down. For example, even when unemployment is high and there are lots of workers available, employers don't generally cut wages, so inflation won't be zero. It also doesn't take into account other factors that also contribute to inflation.
It's a simple tool. It can't do everything. We need more tools.
Claudia Somm is chief economist at New Century Advisors. She used to work for the Fed. She points out one of the factors that's led to inflation over the past few years is supply chain disruption.
The Phillips curve is not useful for that. Like, it's just not in the concept of it. So it really came down to a debate of what's causing inflation.
And lately, it's been difficult to use the Phillips curve to make predictions. Again, economist Ann Owen.
The stability of the Phillips curve has not been great for at least 20 years.
There's no magic button to control inflation, as we've seen. Instead, Owen says it's best to think of the Phillips curve as just one way to understand the economy. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
All right, just a little more work now. It has been a bumpy start to the year for WeWork, the once-upon-a-time flagship co-working business. It filed for Chapter 11 protection last November and just last week finalized a bankruptcy plan that will get it more capital, clear off about $4 billion worth of debt, and close about a third of its locations around the world. But in this age of hybrid work, the co-working industry has actually gotten bigger than just WeWork, and the business model is changing too. Amanda Hoover is a staff writer for Wired, where she had a story the other day on the wider co-working industry, headlined, "Local Co-working Spaces Thrive Where WeWork Dared Not Go." Amanda, thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So as I said, the headline of this piece is "Local Co-working Spaces Thrive Where WeWork Dared Not to Go." Where, oh, where did WeWork dare not to go that these places are thriving now?
Yeah, this story was about a couple of kind of unexpected co-working spaces. I personally went to what was formerly a church on Long Island, still looks like a church, you know, big white steeple. Mm-hmm. The article mentions some other kind of places like this, like a motorcycle repair garage, some old warehouses. Mm-hmm. You know, WeWork has done some outfitting of old spaces, but mostly we think of them as a company where they're renting office spaces in commercial downtowns. And a lot of these places are outside of those commercial downtowns, and they're in these kind of unconventional buildings now turned into offices.
The really interesting part about this is, you know, set aside the church and the motorcycle repair shop, they are distinctly suburban. They're not in, you know, like city centers.
Yeah, or not large city centers, the ones... some of the ones, there's company Switchyards, you know, they're based in mid to large size cities, but maybe in more residential areas is where they have found a lot of success.
What's the theory that you know, says we're going to put it here, but not where, you know, office workers typically congregate?
Yeah, I think people, you know, are looking for convenience and they're looking for community. And what better way to get that than walking 5-10 minutes to work from somewhere that isn't home, but is pretty close to your home. So you're kind of surrounded by your neighbors and your community, but getting out of the house and the very claustrophobic nature that working from home can definitely create.
Well, you know, it's interesting, right? Because we, you know, work is changing. The places we do work is changing. And in a lot of ways, how we work is changing. I was struck, though, by the end of your, literally the last line. Some parts of office life will ultimately stay in place no matter where people decide to work from. We want, not to go back to Starbucks from, you know, 15 years ago, we want that third place.
Yeah, there's been so much that's come out recently about how lonely people are, how lonely Americans are, how lonely workers are. And a lot of people have forged really positive connections that can last for years, you know, based on relationships with their coworkers. But it's much, much harder to do that, obviously, if you aren't forming those bonds that can extend, you know, beyond the day-to-day transactional pieces of work that you do together.
Which I totally agree with, but is that a good foundation for a business model? How are these companies going to do with the OG in this space, WeWork, having, you know, spectacularly not done well?
Well, WeWork has exited bankruptcy, or they're in that process. You know, they got their final approval to do so, and they really still view co-working as a viable business, and they're a much leaner company now. A lot of other companies that are smaller are finding ways to, you know, maybe own the space and, you know, not have those leases, are looking into management agreements and revenue share agreements with landlords, you know, kind of changing some of the riskier pieces of the financial model that came from leasing office space and subleasing it out, hoping to, you know, make a premium from those subleases. And that was kind of WeWork's original model. So we're definitely in a moment where the future of co-working is being put to a test and the viability of it.
You spent a couple hours or a morning, I guess, working out of that converted church. How was it?
It was so interesting because it was kind of like any other modern office in a way. You know, it had a gym. There were people chatting, people heating up their lunch. You are in this beautiful older church, but it's still, you know, a Thursday at work for people.
Thursday at work. Amanda Hoover at Wired talking about co-working spaces, new co-working spaces. Amanda, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday at work, we've got a podcast. If you miss something on the air, you can check it out at marketplace.org or on the platform of your choice. Just follow us wherever you like. Coming up.
They're 2,500 times smaller than a grain of salt.
Ooh, I don't know. That's pretty tiny. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 96 points today, 0.25%. Ended things at 38,807. The NASDAQ, hence the happy music, the really happy music, 330 points to the good, almost 2%. 17,187 today. The S&P 500 gained 62 points, 1.2%. 53.54. Hewlett Packard Enterprise shot up more than 10% today after posting better than expected second quarter earnings. Tech firm also issued full year guidance that beat expectations, helped by demand for its artificial intelligence servers and cloud and data storage. AI is everything these days. Discount retailer Dollar Tree pulled back about 4.9% today on worse than expected second quarter guidance. Company said it's also considering a possible sale of its Family Dollar unit, which has delivered disappointing growth and profits since it was acquired in 2015. If you're not confused already between all the dollar stores, the rival discounter Dollar General, I dare you to keep them straight, which said recently it expects consumer spending to be under pressure for the rest of this year, was basically flat. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace Numbers is supported by GitLab, the AI-powered DevSecOps platform. GitLab, software faster. Marketplace is supported by Amazon Business. From small business to big enterprise and everything in between, Amazon Business helps simplify the supplies buying process. Amazon Business, your partner for smart business buying. And by the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, a nonpartisan organization dedicated to raising awareness and accelerating action on America's fiscal challenges to build a brighter economic future for the next generation. Learn more at pgpf.org.
Support for KQED comes from Star One Credit Union. Members can safely send or receive money in just seconds, 24/7, with Star One's Instant Pay. Online or on Star One's app, Star One Credit Union. In your best interest, StarOne.org. And from Broadway SF, presenting Company, the Tony-winning Best Revival of Musical that reimagines one of Stephen Sondheim's most beloved works. At the Orpheum Theater, now through June 29th. Tickets at BroadwaySF.com.
I'm Scott Schaefer. Today on Political Breakdown, an attempt to recall a conservative school board president in the Riverside County city of Temecula seems to be succeeding. It's been a battle over issues also playing out nationally, like the rights of parents versus transgender kids and banning pride flags and books with references to LGBTQ history. We'll talk about the implications for a similar recall happening here in the Bay Area. It's Political Breakdown today at 5:50 on KQED Radio.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is something we need to tell you about a lot of the economic data that we cover on this program. It's a little weedy, but it's important. The idea of seasonal adjustments. because all times of year are not created economically equal. Here's Marketplace's Dan Ackerman.
Earlier this year, the January jobs report came in hot.
No, come on, this labor market? 353,000 new jobs. 353,000 new jobs.
That's what the headline said. But what was actually happening to real people in the economy, according to Johns Hopkins professor Jonathan Wright?
I'm going to guess they lost well over a million jobs. We can go and look it up.
Wait, what? I did look it up, and he's right. January this year saw 2.8 million fewer workers on non-farm payrolls.
There were a lot of people who were hired for the Christmas holiday season, and those were temporary jobs, and they're gone in January.
This happens every year. Gift shop retailers, delivery drivers, mall Santas, millions of those jobs disappear. If you just looked at the raw payroll numbers,
you would say that there is a massive recession every January.
Which there isn't. And that's why when economists look at data to figure out how the economy is trending, they often seasonally adjust the data. Betsy Stevenson is professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan and former chief economist at the Department of Labor. She remembers wondering about seasonal adjustment as a student.
What is this seasonal adjustment? It sounds so fancy, like there's nothing to see here, ma'am. It's just some seasonal adjustment happening on the side. And I'm like, but what is it?
What it is raw numbers smoothed out to remove those seasonal swings that we know happen every year. Like how retail jobs and hard alcohol sales boom each December, or how construction jobs and beer sales spike every summer.
What we want is to be able to see through those patterns, which can be so big that they would mask and make it hard for us to see real fundamental problems that might be, say, slowing the economy.
So when we hear Kai quelling about January employment,
353,000 new jobs,
Jonathan Wright says,
we should remember that deep inside the BLS, somebody has been doing this adjustment.
And deep inside the Bureau of Labor Statistics is where I found Stephen Mance.
I'm a supervisory mathematical statistician.
He says the BLS has been publishing employment data since the 1800s. Back then, it was the raw jobs numbers, how many actual humans on payrolls each month. But in the 1920s, one of the most important users of that data decided those raw numbers weren't good enough.
The initial seasonal adjustment, a lot of it was done by the Federal Reserve.
The Fed, of course. What, is it going to slash interest rates each January when mall Santas hang up their hats? Fed economists needed a clearer picture of how the fundamentals of the economy were shifting year over year. So they got to work.
With mechanical calculators and graph paper and draftsman's tools.
And created their own seasonally adjusted employment data, which they used to conduct monetary policy. But other folks needed seasonally adjusted data too, like economists, academics, and business journalists. So in the 1960s, thanks to the advent of fast and cheap computers, the BLS decided, all right, we'll do it ourselves and publish the seasonally adjusted data for public radio programs and everyone else to enjoy. Because, says Betsy Stevenson,
you don't really need government stats to tell you that fewer people have a job in January coming out of the Christmas holidays.
She says what you need is to know whether getting a job this January is harder than it was last January. I'm Daniel Ackerman for Marketplace.
Sea level rise is already a pretty big part of the climate change conversation. Less talked about is what a hotter planet is doing to some freshwater lakes. They are getting warmer, which is leading to lots of toxic algae, the kind that can end up killing every other living thing in any given lake. That's exactly the problem at Lake Elsinore, about halfway between LA and San Diego. The small city that surrounds it has spent years trying to keep the lake healthy without too much success. So now it's trying something new. Marketplace's Kaylee Wells headed to the shore to see how it's going.
Last time Danny Taylor came out to Lake Elsinore 15 years ago, the algae was in bloom and the lake was not what he was hoping for.
Brown, smelly.
Not exactly a sight he was racing to return to.
I've been in the area, so I just never came that back down to the water because of that.
When the algae runs rampant like it did 15 years ago, the city has to close the lake to prevent people from getting sick. Putting fresh water in the lake makes the bloom recede. The city of Lake Elsinore can pump it in or it can fall from the sky. And after a while, the algae dies off and the cycle starts again. The city wants to keep the algae to a minimum because it relies on tourists like Danny Taylor who spend time and dollars when they visit the lake. Jack Ferguson with the Elsinore Valley Municipal Water District says the city has invested in a marina. It spruced up the lakeside RV camp.
It's booked out. I don't think you can book a weekend right now. It's already booked out for the weekends through the summer.
Then there's the big annual fishing tournament that just happened.
I think first place is $10,000. The real guys, the serious fishermen come out.
And when the bloom is bad enough, business dries up. Fresh water bodies across the globe are falling victim to this problem as the climate crisis makes water warmer. According to the EPA, 40,000 bodies of water are impaired just in the U.S. Lake Elsinore is the largest natural freshwater lake in Southern California. Now, the city on its shores is spending $2 million to try out a new technology to fix it.
This is a very natural process that occurs in all healthy, balanced water ecosystems.
Nick Diner is the CEO of Moliere. His company's tech is in the lake right now, and as he explains, it doesn't use any chlorine or harmful chemicals. Instead, it uses trillions of really tiny oxygen bubbles, nanobubbles.
Nanobubbles are extremely small bubbles of gas, hence the word nano. They are 2,500 times smaller than a grain of salt.
Bubbles that small aren't light enough to float to the surface. They stay at the bottom of the lake, where oxygen is in shortest supply. Plants and animals then get the oxygen they need to stand a fighting chance. The algae starves, and everyone, but the algae, lives happily ever after.
In simplest terms, nanobubble treatment is helping the lake restore itself.
Standing on the shoreline next to a pair of fishermen, the Water District's Jack Ferguson points to a big white cube sitting quietly about an impressive stone's throw from the water's edge.
That's a nanobubbler machine right there on that barge. That's it. It's probably 80, 90 feet offshore.
The machine has been there since December. And if you look down into the water now, it's a deep blue. Hardly recognizable compared to what Danny Taylor saw 15 years ago.
I came back here to visit, and it's very clean. I'm really impressed. I'll be back here, definitely. It's really, really nice.
So far, it seems to be working. A kayaker peering over the edge can see 12 to 14 feet down. It's some of the best visibility the city has ever recorded. Now, it was a really rainy year, and that usually helps with the lake's water quality. In the hot summer months, the bubbles will have more work to do. The Water District's Jack Ferguson is
waiting to see how long this lasts and the water stays clear and dark blue, but I've never seen it like this.
You've never seen it this dark blue?
Never. This is the first ever.
The city says its measurement of the water's resiliency has doubled, and algae concentrations have dropped by half in the worst spots and disappeared almost entirely in the best ones. In Lake Elsinore, I'm Kaylee Wells for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Crowley, a logistics, energy, and maritime solutions company with nearly 135 years of innovation and a commitment to sustainability. Learn more at Crowley.com. And by Progressive Insurance. Customers can simplify their insurance needs and protect what's important by bundling home and auto. Learn more about bundling at Progressive.com.
This final note on the way out today, saw this in Axios. It's data from the National Association of Restaurants. So, you know, grain of salt. But the restaurant lobbying group says total spending at food service establishments, that is their nomenclature, not mine, spending there is going to hit $1.1 trillion this year. That's a better than 5% bump from 2023. So look, where do you want to go for dinner, right? Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Justin Dueler, Drew Jostet, Gary O'Keefe, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. Jeff Peters is the manager of media production. And I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All Things Considered is just ahead here on KQED Public Radio. After a look at traffic starting this time in Walnut Creek, here's Julie Deppisch.
And they just cleared that wreck involving a cement truck and an SUV on northbound 680 after the 24 interchange. The lanes are open, really backed up into Danville. Then a big rig crash in Dublin, westbound 580 before the 680 interchange. That's in the two right lanes. You're in stop-and-go traffic from Santa Rita. And San Mateo trouble, south 101 of the off-ramp to 3rd Avenue. It's a vehicle into the guardrail, causing delays from Millbrae Avenue. Julie Deppisch for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Another Planet Entertainment, presenting Francis Cabrel at Fox Theater this Thursday, June 6th. Tickets on sale now at Ticketmaster.com, and from Supermicro and NVIDIA, accelerating AI with a wide range of AI servers and the NVIDIA AI Enterprise Software Program. Supermicro is committed to driving AI infrastructure breakthroughs with rack-scale innovations. This is KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highland Sacramento. It's 4:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, ever coveted a neighbor's perfectly manicured emerald green lawn?
Well, a growing movement of natural landscapers would like you to get over it.
There's nothing that is natural about a lawn or a landscape that is completely turf grass.
First, these headlines.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. Hospital records show at least 93 Palestinians have been killed in central Gaza over the past 24 hours. People had fled to the area recently to escape Israel's assault on the southern city of Rafah. More from NPR's Aya Batrawi.
Israel's military says its air force is striking Hamas and its ground troops are operating in limited manner in parts of Bereij and Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. Doctors Without Borders medical referent Karen Huster describes a scene of carnage at Deir al-Balah's Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital.
This morning on my way to the hospital, I saw two donkeys carrying the bodies of at least 8 people who had died in the hostilities of the last night.
She saw a 3-month-old baby with severe burns and crush injuries and says a wounded woman whose 2 kids had been killed died when the hospital in central Gaza lost electricity during the day.
It's just an emotionally overwhelming situation.
Aya Batrawi, NPR News.
Independent advisors to the FDA today recommended updating the COVID vaccines to protect against the latest variants that are infecting people. NPR's Rob Stein has the story.
After a day-long meeting, the FDA advisors unanimously recommended the COVID shots people will be able to get next fall be designed to protect against the so-called JN1 variant. That variant, and the related ones known as VRT variants, have now become the dominant viruses infecting people in the U.S. Although the number of people getting COVID has dropped dramatically, many people are still catching the virus and sometimes even ending up in the hospital or dying from COVID, especially if they're older, unvaccinated, or have other health problems. Rob Stein, NPR News.
On Wall Street, stocks finished higher across the board today. You're listening to NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. Pro-Palestinian protesters disrupted fundraising events with the Vice President, Kamala Harris, on both sides of the bay today. Harris was greeted by hundreds of protesters at events in both Oakland and San Francisco. In San Francisco, Harris spoke at an event at the chapel on Valencia. In preparation for her arrival, more than 75 SFPD officers pushed back a crowd of about 200 protesters and arrested one person. Avalon Edwards is an organizer with Jewish Voice for Peace who disrupted Harris's speech inside the venue.
I said, Vice President Kamala Harris, you are handing this election to Donald Trump by continuing to support this genocide. How many more Palestinians have to die? How much more blood has to be on your hands?
Edwards was removed by police but not charged. Vacaville Mayor John Carley has declined to sign the city's Pride Month proclamation, leaving it to be signed by the vice mayor. Nick McConnell with the Vacaville Reporter says Carley has a contentious relationship with the Solano County Pride Center, which submitted language for the proclamation.
From what I've heard over the last year, reporting on this issue since last June,
folks do care about this, and folks understand that how their elected officials feel about these things and the decisions that their elected officials make about these things really do matter.
In a statement, Solano Pride officials said the mayor removed historical context about discrimination and failed to communicate his concerns with them. I'm Natalia Navarro. This is KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for KQED comes from Berkeley Repertory Theater, presenting Octavio Solis's Mother Road, an epic 21st century journey along Route 66, inspired by John Steinbeck, playing through July 21st, more at berkeleyrep.org. And from Brevo, a customer relationship management platform that can help engage with clients across email, SMS, WhatsApp, and more. For more information, visit brevo.com. That's brevo.com. The heat advisory will continue tomorrow. Lows tonight will be in the lower 60s inland. The National Weather Service says Thursday highs will range from 64 at Ocean Beach to 95 in Santa Rosa. Support for NPR comes from Easy Cater, committed to helping companies from nonprofits to the Fortune 500 find restaurants that cater meetings and events with online ordering and 24/7 live support. Learn more at easycater.com. From Bank of America, offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local to global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. And from the listeners of KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highland Sacramento. We're streaming at kqed.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Hunter Biden's ex-wife and a former girlfriend testified today in a Delaware courtroom about his drug use. The president's son is being tried on federal firearm charges for allegedly lying about his drug use when he bought a gun in 2018. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas has been in the courtroom this week since the trial began, and he joins us now. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
So, Ryan, it sounds like it was a really busy day in court. I want to start with Hunter Biden's ex-wife. What did we hear from her?
So this is Catherine Buell. She was married to Hunter for more than 20 years before they got divorced in 2017. They have three kids together. She was testifying today under subpoena. She wasn't on the stand for very long, only about 30 minutes. But she told jurors that she discovered Hunter was using drugs when she found a crack pipe in an ashtray on their porch in July of 2015. She said she confronted him about it, and Hunter said it was his and acknowledged smoking crack. But Buell told jurors she'd already had suspicions that he was using drugs because Hunter had been discharged from the Navy after failing a drug test. But she was worried for him, for their family. She said she would check his car before their daughter would borrow it to make sure that there weren't any drugs in it when their daughter was driving it. Now on cross-examination, Hunter Biden's attorney, Abby Lowell, asked Buell whether she'd seen Hunter use drugs. She said no, but she did tell jurors that Hunter had told her that he used drugs.
Okay, and today we also heard from Hunter Biden's former girlfriend. What did she have to say?
Right, this is Zoe Keston. She testified under immunity. She was 24 when she met Hunter in December of 2017 at a strip club in Manhattan where she was working. She said that during a private session when they met, he pulled out a pipe and began smoking it. She said she assumed that it was crack cocaine. And then she described for jurors the sort of whirlwind relationship that she and Hunter had over the next 10 months. She talked about how they would spend days together or even a week at a time at luxury hotels in New York and California. She testified that Hunter was smoking crack when they were together every 20 minutes. But she said he was the same charming person when he was smoking crack as when he wasn't. It didn't affect his behavior at all. She said jurors also saw photos that she took. One showed Hunter in a bubble bath with a crack pipe in his hand. She said she saw Hunter buy drugs from dealers in both California and New York. She was with him, she said, when he was cooking crack on his own in L.A. But there were two points in particular that she testified about that were important for prosecutors.
And what were those, Ryan?
Well, one, she testified that when she stayed with Hunter in California in late September of 2018, he was smoking crack cocaine. And that's important because it comes after Hunter did a stint in rehab, and it's evidence that he was using drugs again after getting out of that rehab. She also testified that she would get large sums of cash from ATMs for Hunter, a lot of which, she said, he used to buy drugs. And that's important for prosecutors because those large cash withdrawals continued through the period in October of 2018 when he bought and owned the gun.
Okay, so a lot going on there. How did Hunter Biden's attorney respond to all of this?
Well, on Kesten's testimony, he asked her whether she had any contact with Hunter in October of 2018. That's when he bought the gun and allegedly lied on the forms, the actions that he's charged with in this case. And Kesten said, no, she had no contact with him. She also acknowledged under questioning that Hunter would hand out cash, sometimes large amounts, for her to spend on herself or to pay her back for things. And that is trying to undermine the idea that all of the thousands of dollars he was taking out in cash was just to pay for drugs. Lowell has also tried to poke holes in the testimony of the government's first witness, that's FBI Special Agent Erica Jensen. Lowell said yesterday that when Hunter bought the gun in October of 2018, he didn't think he had an addiction. And he got Jensen to acknowledge that Hunter's texts from October 2018 don't have a lot of talk about drug use. But there's one in particular that prosecutors pointed to on redirect that Hunter sent 2 days after buying the gun, in which he says he was sleeping on a car smoking crack.
That's NPR's Ryan Lucas. Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.
One of the most competitive U.S. Senate races is now officially underway. After yesterday's primary in Montana, incumbent Senator John Tester, a Democrat, will face Republican Tim Sheehy, a business owner from Bozeman. That election could be key to which party controls the upper chamber next year. Montana Public Radio's Shaylee Rager reports.
Hey, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Nice to meet you. Yeah, you too.
38-year-old Tim Sheehy prides himself on his identity as a former Navy SEAL and founder of two companies. Sitting in his office inside an airplane hangar in Belgrade, Montana, Sheehy defended his lack of political experience.
When someone new comes along to try to bring a fresh face and fresh set of ideas, they're immediately attacked and disparaged. And I think there's a lot of hypocrisy there.
Sheehy has never held elected office. Originally from Minnesota, he moved to Montana in 2014. In 2020, he started a 20,000-acre cattle ranch with two partners. His Democratic opponent and incumbent, U.S. Senator John Tester, has longtime roots in the state, a third-generation farmer from Big Sandy. Following Sheehy's primary win, Tester lashed out at his opponent, telling MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell that folks are trying to turn Montana into a playground for the rich.
Quite frankly, I've got a lot of equipment that I've owned longer than he's been in the state of Montana.
Not everyone is pleased with Tester, like Nathaniel Palmer, a conservative-leaning voter and U.S. Army veteran from Billings.
So somebody new would probably be better. The issue is, I don't know much about the other person to really say, like, I support them. I know that they say they're a vet and everything, but that doesn't mean a lot to me. Because you can say, like, oh, I'm a nice person and be a, you know, completely not.
Yet Sheehy is using that military experience. He was awarded the Bronze Star with Valor and the Purple Heart to appeal to voters. Speaking at a GOP fundraising dinner earlier this year, he explained why he's running.
To sum it up, I'm here because I love this country. I've fought for this country. I've lost friends for this country. My wife fought for this country. Our country's in great peril. We are at a crossroads of the nation.
The stakes in this race are high, including who controls the U.S. Senate and whether or not Republicans can push out the last Democrat holding statewide office. Tuesday's primary results show that approximately a quarter of Republican primary voters chose a candidate other than Sheehy. But about 91% of the same voters supported former President Donald Trump, according to AP results. He backs Sheehy. Sheehy is still introducing himself to voters, and recent questions have come up over an incident at Glacier National Park a few years back. The Washington Post first reported that Sheehy was cited in 2015 for accidentally discharging a firearm that lodged a bullet in his forearm at the park in northwest Montana. Sheehy had previously said the bullet in his arm is from his days in active combat. His timeline of events is inconsistent with the park ranger's 2015 account. That was detailed in a summary the National Park Service released recently. He's also resisted releasing his medical records that may show when he sustained the bullet wound. In an interview with Montana Public Radio, he says he shouldn't have to release medical records if Tester doesn't, pointing to Tester's story of losing three fingers in a childhood meat grinding accident.
Why would I release personal medical records to a press that's been nothing but hostile to me since the day we announced? Why would I give them information that's personal to me? They don't ask questions about John Tester's fingers getting cut off.
This all comes before the general election season between these two candidates even officially opened. That starts now. Polls show a close race between the former Navy SEAL and the farmer from Big Sandy. For NPR News, I'm Shaylee Riker in Helena.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. 10 years ago, the NBA issued a lifetime ban from basketball to LA Clippers owner Donald Sterling after his racist remarks were leaked to the press. A new FX limited series called Clipped tells the story behind that fallout. And, says NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, the show is also a tale of race, striving, and the inevitability of compromise.
As Clipped opens, a boisterous Lawrence Fishburne is playing coach Doc Rivers, a former NBA All-Star arriving in Los Angeles in 2013. He hopes to lead the team he once played for to a championship, but the complacency of some long-tenured staffers is a problem.
The Clippers have never won a championship. How many times have you made it to the second round of the playoffs? Just the second round?
Twice.
That's crazy. No offense, but you guys are the worst organization in sports.
Turns out that's not Rivers' biggest challenge. His real problem is erratic owner Donald Sterling, played as an irascible crank by Modern Family alum Ed O'Neill. Sterling is a real estate mogul who treats the team and its players like his personal playthings. He ties up business meetings with stream of consciousness ramblings over the phone.
God shed his grace on thee.
How long does he usually go on?
That's 20 minutes, sometimes an hour.
Sometimes all day.
And it gets worse when Sterling's in person. He barges into the locker room after a game, mistakenly suggesting that star Blake Griffin, whose mother is white and father is Afro-Haitian, is actually Latina.
Look at this guy. Look at this mug on this guy. This could be the next Antonio Banderas.
Antonio Banderas? Who thinks Blake's Latino?
But Clipped really takes off when a recording of the owner's racist comments are made public by gossip site TMZ. Sterling argues with his assistant, who often acted like his girlfriend, urging her to stop posting pictures socializing with black people.
You're supposed to be a delicate white or delicate Latina girl.
I am a mixed girl, and you're in love with me. I'm black and Mexican, whether you like it or not, and you want me to have hate towards black people.
I don't want you to have hate. That's what people, they turn things around. I want you to love them. Privately.
Suddenly, everyone connected with Sterling and the team must decide how to react, and their decisions speak to the power of money and privilege in society. The series' secret weapon is Australian actress Jackie Weaver, who provides a layered performance as Sterling's wife of 60 years, Shelley. At first, she appears good-natured and long-suffering, struggling to handle her husband's dalliances before revealing she has more power than many realize.
We bought the Clippers together. Every property we acquired, we got together. But it's Donald's first name on all of our buildings. It's Donald they call the owner of our team.
But it's Coach Rivers' story which captures the thorny issues the mostly black team faced. They're torn between playing for a championship or upending their chances by expressing their rage and boycotting the team. The coach's friend and confidant in all this is LeVar Burton, playing himself. He tells Rivers how tough it is for famous black men to express rage and why he keeps the chains from his role in Roots on display in his house.
I keep my chains on the wall in the living room. I want my guests to know, while I am unquestionably their friend, I am also absolutely filled with rage.
Moments like this elevate Clip's story, though its ultimate message about the ubiquity of compromise and the enduring power of wealth might be a bit tough to swallow. I'm Eric Deggans.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Your KQED traffic update at 4:48 starts with trouble in Danville. Here's Julie Deppish.
Yeah, got a new crash on southbound 680 after Sycamore Valley Road. That's the second lane for the left, blocked with a car and a minivan backing up to El Cerro. It's an old gray trouble, a pickup truck and a car here on the shoulder, northbound 680 before Sheridan Road. And we've got a crash in South San Jose, the southbound 85 connector ramp to 101 South. A crash involves a car in the left lane and another on the right-hand shoulder. Julie Deppish for
KQED.
Julie will have another update in 10 minutes. Support for KQED comes from the California Academy of Sciences. From redwood forests to deserts, breathtaking coasts to bustling cities, visitors can be inspired at California State of Nature, a new exhibit. Tickets at calacademy.org. And from Xfinity, customers can get wall-to-wall Wi-Fi that extends coverage throughout the home. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary. It is lawnmower season, but some homeowners say it's time to shift from well-trimmed lawns to more environmentally friendly landscaping. Details are coming up on All Things Considered.
I'm Alexis Madrigal. Next time on Forum, driverless taxis have become a common sight in San Francisco, even a tourist attraction. But their learning models and the traffic scenarios that confound them have remained a blind spot for California regulators. From long-haul trucking to package delivery, and yes, those Waymo cars, we're talking about autonomous vehicles. That's at 9 a.m. right here on KQED.
I'm Leslie McClurg, in for Mina Kim. Next time on Forum at 10 a.m., Ruth Whitman is a feminist writer. She's also the mother of three sons. Her new book, Boy Mom, asks how to raise good men in an age where people on the right weaponize male concerns and people on the left dismiss them. We'll hear about her reporting and her own experiences as a boy mom. That's Forum at 10 a.m. on KQED.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. For many homeowners and businesses, it is that time of year to roll out the lawnmower and trim the yard. Those neat plots of green are part of an ongoing debate over traditional grass yards, more natural landscaping, and the impact on the environment. Harvest Public Media contributor Teresa Holmesey reports.
In the summer, Denise Whitebread Fanning's yard is filled with flowers like zinnias, black-eyed Susans, and milkweed. Her overgrown garden sticks out among the rows of tidy lawns here in Mount Pleasant, Michigan. But she says she's never understood the desire for manicured green grass.
It's so beautiful to come out here and witness this like evolving ecosystem and to see all of the new life that is finding home here that didn't exist on this land 2 years ago.
Fanning is among a growing group that's reimagining lawns. Dozens of municipalities across the country, including Mount Pleasant, are considering loosening restrictions on the height of grass or even what can be grown. There are strong feelings about what lawns should look like.
A lot of people really view their yard as like an extension of themselves.
Michael Barnes is a horticulture social scientist at the University of Minnesota. He says lawns are often synonymous with the American dream and homeownership. They're welcoming spaces to gather and play.
Having a nicely maintained yard is like part of feeling good about not only your contribution to the neighborhood, but also like fitting in with the rest of the community.
He says lawns have been around for centuries. As early as the 1200s, people were already making guidelines on how to cultivate a grassy space. They later became popular with European elites around their intricate gardens. But the modern American lawns we know are a more recent invention.
Really that post-war suburbanization that drew lawns into kind of the de facto form of vegetation in urban areas.
Lawns are also now highly industrialized. The landscaping service industry in the U.S. has a market value of around $150 billion. Think fuel for mowers, fertilizers, and more.
There's nothing that is natural about a lawn or a landscape that is completely turf grass.
Zach Shum, an entomologist at Iowa State University, says monoculture lawns are essentially ecological dead zones.
Not many insects are utilizing turf grass spaces for food, water, and shelter. A lot of them tend to be pests. All of the pollinators we think of, a lot of the beneficial insects utilize flowering plants, larger trees, shrubs, things like that.
And it takes tons of water to keep lawns green. According to an EPA estimate, landscape irrigation accounts for nearly a third of all residential water use, about 9 billion gallons a day. Water usage is what caught geographer Christina Malese's attention when she moved to Montana from Italy and noticed how her new neighbors watered their lawns.
At times they would just keep watering, even maybe when it's thunderstorm. And so I said, oh, interesting.
Her 2005 study for NASA estimated lawns are the largest irrigated crop in the U.S., 3 times that of corn.
That captures where generally most of us live in cities, and that's where we can maybe have an impact on changing our behaviors.
By using less water or having smaller lawns, Lazy says she doesn't know, nearly 20 years later, whether lawns take up more or less space. Urban sprawl has increased, but yard grass is also becoming impractical in places prone to drought like California, where she currently lives. So in some places, there's been a shift to more resilient landscapes, and in others, a transition from grass to plants, like in Denise Fanning's yard, which she calls a pollinator haven.
Even the smallest thing, like planting one beneficial pollinator plant, right, in your yard that wasn't there last year is going to feed more pollinators this year than before. Making a choice to not put pesticides on your lawn anymore, small little things matter.
Fanning understands that her busy, colorful lawn is an acquired taste, and a taste that seems to be growing as more people take into account the impact a manicured lawn can have on the environment. For NPR News, I'm Teresa Holmesey in Mount Pleasant, Michigan.
This week, something different popped up on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Houses. From tiny homes to big ones built in hours, it's a showcase to highlight new ways to make housing cheaper, faster, and more plentiful. As NPR's Laurel Wamsley reports, these innovations have real urgency as many Americans struggle to find an affordable place to live.
On what's normally a wide-open, grassy space on the National Mall, halfway between the U.S. Capitol and the Washington Monument, a small, temporary village is sprouting. A forklift goes by carrying a tiny house, and workers assemble what looks like an instant log cabin. This is the Innovative Housing Showcase, staged by HUD, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development.
What a great day to be in America's front lawn, isn't it?
That's Acting HUD Secretary Adrienne Todman. She says this event is about showcasing the future and expanding the country's housing supply.
And one of the ways that we know to bring down costs is to just build more housing. Am I right? Just build more. Build, build, build.
After the speeches, I walk into the house that served as the backdrop, a bright, stylish, manufactured home, what used to be known as a mobile home.
This is the first single-section duplex approved by HUD.
Richard Smith is a sales manager at Cavco, the company that built this home. HUD sets national building standards for manufactured homes and recently changed its code to allow homes like this. Smith explains why making a duplex manufactured home matters.
It allows us to get more affordable homes, two living areas in one space, especially for infill areas. So it really just helps just a piece of solving the affordable housing crisis.
He says one reason they're here is to show that homes like this can have a place in more urban areas. And they continue to meet real needs elsewhere.
Especially in rural areas, this is really the only opportunity for folks to have new housing. You just don't have the tradespeople, the developers that want to go into smaller, more rural areas. So that's a real niche that we serve, but we can serve a whole lot more than that.
Further along the mall stands a traditional-looking house that wasn't here 2 days ago. It's two stories and is ready for siding and a roof.
Hi there.
Hello.
Mark Cyrus works for 84 Lumber.
So we framed the house as off-site manufacturing. So it was trucked in and done a little under 6 hours, start to finish.
So wait, what's the innovation here?
So the innovation is the floor cassettes that are pre-manufactured off-site, the longer walls with windows in them, and then the roof cassettes. So when it comes in, it's literally, they're not building nothing. They're just putting together kind of like a puzzle.
With typical stick framing, it might take 2 weeks to do all this. But here, using these materials, like the pre-built flooring sections, have cut that time way down. That's a big deal, because for developers, the time before a project is completed costs big money, and that gets passed along to the home buyer.
For builders, it's all about cycle time. Cycle time is how quick you can build a house.
And the faster they can build the house,
the more affordable they can give houses to the American people.
Expanding the country's supply of housing will need a lot of solutions, and faster, cheaper methods like these are one way to move the needle. Laurel Wamsley, NPR News, Washington.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at NerviveHealth.com. From the NPR Wine Club, where members can explore wines from around the world, and every purchase supports NPR's high-quality journalism, available to adults 21 or older, nprwineclub.org, and from the listeners of KQED. A report on this current Western heat dome is...